The Paul Kuharsky Podcast is brought to you by the Yazoo Brewing Company, celebrating 15 years of beer in Nashville, Tennessee.
Welcome in to a new edition of the Paul Kuharsky Podcast from paulkuharsky.com. I'm Paul Kuharsky. I've said my name three times in the first sentence. Broadcasting from an undisclosed home office location in Brentwood, Tennessee. I cover the Tennessee Titans in the NFL. I am one-third of the Midday 180 on 104.5 The Zone in Nashville. And this podcast is brought to you by Yazoo Brewery. They make great beer of every variety in Nashville, Tennessee. You should check it out next time you're ordering a beer at the bar or picking up a six-pack somewhere. It's great summer stuff. The Hefeweizen's a favorite of mine. You've heard our guest from this week on the Midday 180 a couple times, and hopefully more soon. He's kind enough to join me to kind of expand on a couple things I wanted to ask him about. Blake Bedingfield was part of the Titans scouting department for 19 drafts. And if I'm not mistaken, Blake, the last 6 years that you were with the team, you were director of college scouting. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
That's a big title. Very big title for a guy who has gone on to big things as a coach of his son's baseball team. How far did you guys end up going?
You know, we actually had a really good season. We played tournament ball, so each week was a different tournament, and sometimes we made it to the end, but never the big championship. But you know, we did well as a young team with a new group of boys and new coaching staff, and so we had a nice year.
You've had a lot of experience with a lot of coaches watching staffs for 19 seasons with the Titans pass through. What's something maybe you learned from coaching? This was a 12-year-old team, right? Your son, or 11?
Yes. It was an 11U baseball team. And you know, you can always take things from different coaches that you coached with or you've been around. And I think probably the overwhelming thing is being prepared. Being prepared before you walk out to practice, being prepared before you go to a game. I've always been a very organized person. It's something I've always prided myself on in my personal life as well as my professional life, and I carried it on as a coach as well. But you better be prepared when you're dealing with 11 youth kids and you're dealing with 22 parents. You want to be prepared when you walk into a baseball field or a basketball court or a football field. You better be prepared ahead of time to have equal playing time if that's the league that you're in, or at least put your players in a position to be at the best spots and have a chance to win.
Very cool. I'm wise to fall out of it now with an 8-year-old, but I'm having trouble being quiet. I need a lot of work.
That's the number one rule as a coach is you take the parents during the first practice and tell them that they're not allowed to coach their son or daughter during the practice or game time. They have them before the game, not during, and then they have them after the game. And that's one of the number one rules as a coach, to always kind of separate the parents, unless they're helping out, separate them from the field during that 1 hour, 2 hour game or practice time.
I need to go for more walks. Last week on this podcast, I was it with Samari Roll, who is one of my very favorite guys that's been on the Titans during my time covering them since 96. And that led me to come into a conversation with you. I wanted to ask, first off, where you think he ranks among the cornerbacks that you've seen pass through Nashville on the Titans, and kind of assess his style. We'll start there.
Samari would rank number one as the best corner that I was a part of with the Titans for all those years. Samari just had a great understanding of the game, very instinctive player, very smart player. This guy knew personnel in the league. He knew who he was playing against, the receiver on the other side. He knew how they tried to attack him. But the great part of Samari is he had a great big picture view of the defense that he played in at that time, a lot of it under Greg Williams, and he knew what his role was, but he also knew what the role was for Steve Jackson, the nickelback, or Dane and Sidney later, Denard Walker, the other outside corner. He knew how teams were going to attack Denard. He knew what his strengths and weaknesses were, and he knew that teams were going to attack him. And Samori was such a smart player that he learned, and he was very savvy, learned later in his career to kind of play coy, to kind of play off receivers that he knew he could cover with his speed and make plays on the ball. He did that a number of times. I remember a Monday night game versus Washington Redskins where right before halftime he picked the ball off and took it back all the way. That was him baiting the quarterback into making a throw. And Samori could do that really later in his career, but was just an outstanding. He had really good foot quickness, very good speed. Didn't have great strength in terms of numbers because of his frail size, but he was actually a stronger tackler when he wanted to be. And he was a really good press, cover, bump and run player from the line of scrimmage because he knew how to use his feet. He knew how to use his hands to attack, but he also had great vision to the quarterback. Samori just had a well-rounded game. But the best thing I think about him was his brain, his instincts for the game, and instincts for the ball in the air. Samori just had a really nice – so he is my number one corner that I would take right now of all the players that have suited up for the Titans.
He told me – I asked him about the physicality, you know, because it's clear heck, guys bigger than him, including Deion Sanders, were not renowned tacklers. And he said that he wasn't ashamed of that he would nose in when it was necessary and when it was prudent. But even Greg Williams, the defensive coordinator early in his career, said, you know, that he had to pick his spots. And he knew that squaring up against Corey Dillon, if there were other people around and it wasn't a must-make play and getting dinged, probably wasn't going to benefit the team in the long run. And I know that's a running joke when you call talk about a cornerback who doesn't necessarily isn't that well rounded, quote unquote. But I think everybody in his day and in the present day would take a guy that could cover like that. His tackling isn't high on the resume of things you're looking from him, right?
You know, he wasn't known for being a great tackler. But the one thing Samori did is he picked his spots. He picked his spot in big games, whether it's big competition like Jacksonville at the time was one of our biggest competitors, and they had Jimmy Smith. You're going to have to wrap up and tackle Jimmy Smith. He had a strong lower body. He broke a lot of tackles. You know, those type players, Samori came to play, and he came to play in all the part of the game at that time. You know, I remember in playoff games, Samori was a very good tackler. He'd come up on some of those bubble screens that Indianapolis with Peyton Manning would run, and he would come up and stick the receiver right then and there. And, you know, he didn't have a problem tackling, but, you know, his slight frame, he wasn't going to survive for 16 weeks if he was just going to try to knock the receiver's head off every time. We needed him to do other things, and that's get his hands on the ball, make plays, and really be a huge part of that defensive backfield.
Who would come to mind as maybe the next batch of cornerbacks on this roster over the last 19 years that you'd put behind him?
You know, I think the group next would be in that Cortland Finnegan, Alteron Verner, Jason McCourty, and that group is very good from the standpoint of Cortland came in the league as a nickelback and really took off. He was an excellent blitzer. He had great speed, highly competitive, just really didn't know how to cover and know routes as well at that time early on in his career, but was excellent inside at the nickelback. Everything you wanted in a nickel, which you could match up with a quicker, shiftier type receivers and also tackle and blitz, he would do it all, and he would do it all at 100% at all times. Cortland had great speed. He was a 4.37 guy coming out of Samford, but he was used to playing kind of in the middle because he played safety in college. So when we moved into corner, took a little bit of a transition period to move him outside at corner, but he was an excellent nickel back. And at that time when we had our defense, you know, a nickel back was a starter. And really today, three corners is really considered a starter. Even though you may line up on first down with two corners and two safeties, you're going to end up going to the five-man package pretty quick. So, you know, he was a starter in our defense early on, and then he moved to the outside and had a really nice career, made a lot of plays on the ball, been an excellent tackler, and brought a physical nature to the game. You know, I thought Alteron Verner was probably the exact opposite of a workout type warrior. He was an average speed at best, average size, but he was a very smart player, excellent hands, excellent ball skills, really knew how to position his body and well on the defense. He could match up with receivers because of his understanding of route awareness and understanding of who he's playing against. Really played within the scheme very well. No one that you would ever sit there and go, he's a number one corner in the league. He's not. But he was a good number two for a number of years. And for us, he really played well within the scheme. You know, I think Jason McCourty was probably the exact opposite of Alteron Verner, where Jason was a later round draft choice in the sixth, seventh round. And he had great speed, but not really very good instincts. And even today, he's not really an instinctive player. But Jason had really good speed. He was a really good kid that learned well and learned quickly. And because of that speed and his aggressiveness, you know, he was able to play and play quickly and made a lot of plays. We ran a lot of quarter coverage with Jason early in his career, and he made a lot of plays with his face turned toward the quarterback. You know, he was a guy that I thought got better quick from his rookie year to his second year. You know, I think Pac-Man Jones had all the talent in the world, and, you know, if the off-the-field issues when he was with us didn't really surface, he would probably be number one or number two on the list. He had the talent. He had the ball skills. He had the speed. He had the competitiveness. If he would have put the time in learning receivers and learning how to play the game, you know, he could have really been a special player for us. He's gone on to have a nice career, but he had a lot of talent, a lot of instincts to play, and, you know, I think probably the next guy would be Denard Walker, and it was because of what we asked him to do. He was a man-to-man corner, and that's it. If you ask him to play zone or ask him to read and be able to play off and react to balls, that's not what he does. He's a man-to-man corner. He presses at the line of scrimmage. He had great size and strength and speed and very poor ball skills, couldn't find the ball in the air, but he really wasn't asked to a lot.
Do you think Adoree Jackson or Malcolm Butler have a chance when they're done in their time with the Titans to challenge Samari Roll for that top spot on this list?
You know, I don't think so. I think Adoree's got a lot of ability. He's going to be the undersized guy. He has really good speed, excellent speed. He's a competitive player for his size. I think Adoree, if he really continues to ascend in his career, I think he could definitely, you know, overtake a Corlin Finnegan and definitely overtake an Alteron Verner or a Jason McCourty. I think with just sheer speed and talent, the competitive nature that he has, I think he could rise up. I think Samari had that really great ability to learn the defense, understand it, and know where everybody is on the field. I just think that's so important. And maybe Adoree gets that and, you know, really dedicates himself to the game. I remember stories with Samari when he was in the building, whether he was in the training room or I'd see him in the lunchroom. You know, he always wanted to talk personnel. He always wanted to talk college players at the time coming out in the draft. This is a guy that studied players, not just in the NFL, but in college. He really had a great love for personnel and studying players. I think on the other side, Malcolm Butler, I think Malcolm's going to be a nice player for the Titans. I really do. But whether he can ascend to the Samari Roll level, I just don't think so. I don't think he's that kind of player. I think he could probably get in that top five range, and that's probably where he'll sit.
I might be missing a coordinator here. I'm going Williams, Schwartz, Cecil, Gray, and then Gray / Williams again. LeBeau and now Pease. Am I missing somebody there, defensive coordinator wise?
You had Jerry Gray.
Yeah, so William Schwartz, Cecil, Jerry Gray, and then Greg Williams came in with Jerry Gray, Dick LeBeau, now Dean Pease. Which of those guys maybe broadly asked the most of the corners? Which of them maybe asked the least of the corners?
You know, I think Greg asked a lot of his corners because he put them on an island a little. A lot of times he bump and run with Samari and Denard, and he asked them to man up all over the field. And that's when we were able to draft a Javon Kearse. It changed Denard Walker and Samardzija Rowe's game. They had to cover for less time because of the pass rush. You know, you also had a veteran group of safeties at that time with Marcus Robinson and Blaine Bishop. So they did have that veteran group with them to, you know, help them out. But they asked a lot of them at that time. I think, you know, when you go through the years with Greg and then Schwartzy, you know, Schwartzy probably didn't have – he kind of lost Samari and Denard at that time, and he had a little different group. He was always – it was the Pac-Man. It was Jason McCourty. It was Cortland Finnegan. He did a really nice job and asked a lot of Cortland Finnegan early on in his career to be the nickelback and to put so much on his shoulders for a guy that really didn't play a lot of corner in college. So Schwartzy did ask a lot, but I think when you ask a receiver – I mean, when you ask a corner to cover receivers from the start – and you're just going to man up and play, that's a tough assignment all day, especially when you're playing the Marvin Harrisons and the Jimmy Smiths and, you know, those type of guys. It's tough. And later on, Dick LeBeau, Dick would ask more of combination coverages, a lot of zone, but he would also ask them to blitz a lot more and, you know, probably put some pressure on the corners from that standpoint from the blitzes. But, you know, I think Greg probably asked the most of his corners.
So I wanted to cover two scouting areas with you. And first, you and I talked about this. I wanted to get the top three workouts you were ever at, and I know you weren't at every workout of every guy the Titans drafted by any means, but in the guys that you scouted in that way, let's go from three up to number one, the best workouts you saw. We're going to do one now, then we're going to pause, and the rest are going to be members only. I'd like you to kind of characterize that guy, that workout, how much that swayed or influenced the pick, and what made it memorable for you. So who would be third on that list for you?
You know, I think third for me would be Tyrone Calico out of Middle Tennessee State. Tyrone was 6'3", he was 222 pounds, and I remember at the combine he ran a 4.37 and had a phenomenal workout. But what really supplanted him and made him a Titan was the workout at Middle Tennessee State later in the spring in March before the draft. Myself, the general manager, offense coordinator, receivers coach, all went down, head coach, all went down to Middle Tennessee to see Tyrone and work him out. And we actually took Billy Volek with us, our backup quarterback at the time, with us to throw to Tyrone. And one of the knocks on Tyrone was his hands. You know, were they good enough, that type of thing. And you know, he didn't have 9 or 10 hands on a scale. He was more the 6 to 7 range. But when you add in the size and the speed factor and the in his career wasn't used a lot at middle, was kind of coming on in his senior year. So, you know, he was a player at that workout. We met with him before. He had a great grasp of the offense. He was learned at Middle Tennessee State, and he could really grasp our offense with the Titans. We installed a little bit with him on the board, and he was great. What really did it was when we took him to the field and Billy threw to him. Billy always had a nice arm. He was a good short to intermediate passer, had enough he had a good catchable deep ball, but Tyrone could outrun his arm. And one of the things after the workout, Billy threw probably 75 passes to Tyrone, didn't drop any that I remember. I remember Billy walking over to Floyd Reese, our general manager at the time, and said, "If you don't draft this guy, Steve McNair and I are going to kick your butt." And that was something that, you know, from a quarterback that was on the roster right now that had enough cachet to say that to the general manager, for the general manager to just watch that workout and the head coach, and then to say, you know, look at this guy right in our own backyard. Let's select that receiver. And Tyrone had a nice rookie year and was really coming on in the second year before the ACL.
Yeah, and then injuries ultimately undid him, and he's one of those guys on the long list of receivers that just haven't found a way to make it work in Tennessee. Not too many beyond Derek Mason and Drew Bennett, who panned out to the degree you guys and Titans fans would have liked. So there's your taste from former Titans College scouting director Blake Benningfield of what he's going to offer. We're going to pick up with his second and first best workouts he was a part of for guys who became Titans. And we're going to talk about how the Titans viewed Jake Locker, Vince Young, and Marcus Mariota as they prepared to draft them. All of that available to members after this short break. If you're not a member, it's a great time to join. $5.99 a month is the cost of a pricey beer, a couple bottles of water. You can get 12 months for the price of 11. Training camp is about to start at the end of the month. I'm a lone, unique voice on this team. It's a bunch of kids and some good people who work for the team and aren't always necessarily going to be able to give you the analysis that I will, and that's no slight to them. But if you've got to have a jersey, if you've got to have tickets to a certain game, if you've got to have this good luck charm and that Titans memento, you've got to have a membership to paulkuharski.com to call yourself a real fan. It's brought to you by Yazoo Brewery. This podcast will return for members in just a minute. We're back with part two of the paulkuharski.com podcast. My guest, Blake Bedingfield, talking with us. We talked in great detail about Titans cornerbacks in part one, which you just listened to. He told us about Tyrone Calico's workout being the third best that he was part of as a scout during 19 drafts he was a part of with the Titans. We're brought to you by Yazoo, a great Nashville-made beer. I'm partial to the Hefeweizen. Grab one. It'll cool you down this summer. A fine Nashville product, which I consider myself now, as funny as that sounds. I've lived here now longer than I've lived anywhere else. So like it or not, I am part of Nashville. And Blake, we'll pick up where you left off. So Tyrone Calico, the third most impressive workout you saw. Who was the second most impressive?
The second most impressive workout from just a physical standpoint was Jared Cook. Jared was 6'5", 246 pounds. He went to the combine and ran a 4.49, and I remember I always sit on the opposite side of the 40s. I like to not have a lot of people around me when the 40s are run at the combine inside the, at that time it was the RCA Dome. And I enjoy kind of being able to watch all the different workouts. And Jared's workout there, before I get to the school part, you know, Jared's workout there, he was a real long, athletic player that was used in the South Carolina offense sparingly. He had really good athleticism, really, really big, wide arms, long arms, big hands, great receiving ability from that standpoint, but just used sparingly in the offense. So he ran the 4.49, which is receiver, great, you know, really good receiver numbers at 6'5", 240, 46 pounds, even though he was a tight end. He went over to the vertical jump area, and what they do first is they put you up against the wall and they measure your reach. And I'm sitting there with all the different positions that have gone through, and most of the time the they stretch you out from the top to the bottom, and they measure you out, and they call out the number of your reach. And most of the tight ends I'm hearing 94, 96, 95, 96, and then I hear 104. And I immediately looked down to see who it was, because it wasn't in my clear view. I had to look down to see who it was, and I see it's Jared Cook. And so I see a guy 6'5", and now he's stretching from top to bottom. He's 104 inches, and that's an 8'6" area there. And then he goes out and jumps 40 inches in the vertical. So you had the 4.49 speed and the 40-inch vertical. He had a nice workout on the field, but then you move forward to that workout at South Carolina and you go, this guy's got it all. He's got a lot of athleticism, really untapped route running ability, untapped ability as a receiver, whether it's an attached on the line of scrimmage, which he was just an average, below average blocker at best, or a detached where he could really be a bigger wide receiver and a red zone threat. And, you know, when we got him, he was a guy that really needed some work. He was raw in his routes, and the lack of receiving ability with his hands showed up. Even though he had solid hands, a lot of guys that really struggle running routes will drop balls. Balls get to them quicker from the NFL quarterbacks than they do from the college and before his head on the balls there. So there was a little bit of growing pains with Jared, but his work out of South Carolina and the combine was off the charts for a guy that's his size, with his wingspan, with his catching radius, his hand size, and everything. And, you know, he was just a guy that we plucked later in the third, or in the third round, and really thought we had something there. He's obviously still in the league and producing, but he had an outstanding workout at the combine and at his workout at South Carolina.
So number three for you was Tyrone Calico, who didn't really pan out largely. We'll never know, but injuries slowed him down, so we don't know if he would have panned out or not. Jared Cook had some production, but didn't turn into necessarily the star I imagine you guys hoped. And he's done some things in the league since he left, including a phenomenally important catch for Green Bay. Still playing. I am guessing that number one on this list from you of the best workouts you witnessed personally of guys who ended up on the Titans was a more influential player for this team once he got here. Am I right?
It was. The best workout I've seen was Chris Johnson out of East Carolina. You know, the story goes back to Chris's freshman year, and I'll say this. When I went to East Carolina, I used to scout that area as an area scout. Chris was a freshman at East Carolina, and I actually went there to see two senior running backs that were on the list that were starters the year before. And when I went into East Carolina, neither one of the seniors actually stepped on the field. And I kept seeing this little guy, number five, running away from everybody. And I went immediately out of the film room and went into the running backs coach's room and said, who is this number five? Where are the two senior running backs that had really good years the year before? And he said, oh, they're not going to play. Number five is special. You know, he was a guy that shouldn't be at East Carolina. He should be at Florida State. You know, he was a guy that graduated late from high school, and his test score came in late, so that's why we got him at East Carolina. But, you know, he was someone that from his freshman year on, I couldn't wait to see run. You know, they told me stories of 4.3 and or even faster. And, you know, at that point, you don't really believe. You see what you see on film. But so we get fast forward to the combine, and you know, he runs the 4.2, and it was fast. And in person, seeing the guy run, I mean, it was world-class speed, and it's what I envision seeing out of a guy that is in the Olympics running the 100-meter dash. I remember interviewing Chris after running the 40 at the combine, and I asked him, I said, you know, he was from the state of Florida, which is a lot of fast players, a lot of fast athletes in the state of Florida. I said, did you run track? And he said, yes, I ran the 100 meters. I said, have you ever been beat? And he said, I've been beat once. And I said, who was that? And he said, have you ever heard of Walter Dix? Well, Walter Dix was in the Olympics and won a silver medal in the 100-meter dash. That was the only person to ever beat Chris in a 100-meter dash in high school. So fast forward to the combine. He had a really nice speed, obviously outstanding, broke the record. But then go to his workout at East Carolina. You saw more of the well-rounded player. You saw the hands. You saw the burst, the explosion as soon as he could touch the ball. Fast players sometimes are build up to top end speed players. They can build up the last 20 yards of a 40-yard dash. Chris's speed was instant. He could put one foot in the ground, his second step to his third, he was at full speed, and he could run away. There were so many days after the workouts, once we drafted him, there were so many days in the OTAs and training camps and for years with Chris that I would see him in practice, and players would challenge their speed up against Chris on the defensive side of the ball, trying to run with him, trying to catch him, and he would put it in 75%, 80%, and never really get to that fifth gear, and he would just blow everybody away. His speed was special, his explosion in his lower body and his feet and his hips and his legs was just amazing to see that kind of speed. I haven't seen anything like it since. And he was something really to watch, especially in person. You really never got a feel for it on film as much as you did watching him run in person.
How much was he the target that year in the first round? I remember thinking that you guys were thinking running back and foolishly thinking that running back would be Felix Jones, who was, in fact, off the board by the time you guys were picking. But I imagine you were actually happy that he was off the board and Johnson was still there. How much of a difference did you have between those two guys, and how much was he a target for you?
You know, he was definitely the target for us. Once we sat down and we kind of interviewed him and talked to him and, you know, got past kind of the, just the initial, deal with Chris playing at a smaller school, being a slight frame guy. You know, there were other running backs in that draft that, that we liked as well. But, you know, Felix was a player that we thought was solid. I remember Rashad Mendenhall. He was a running back out of Illinois, a bigger, running back, and he was good. Jonathan Stewart was in that draft as well, and you know he was a solid running back. But Chris was just one of those players that we thought could change the offense, change everything that we do. Really gave us a home run hitter that we didn't have. We didn't have a home run hitter on the field, and we felt like he was that guy. When he touched the ball, he could hit it over the fence, and he could go the distance, and. He was just that kind of athlete, but he was really the target. And after a certain point, that wasn't a great draft. If you remember, it was a lot of offensive linemen. There were a lot of busts in that draft as well. I remember the Vernon Golston and players like that. There really wasn't a great draft top to bottom, but you know, he was one of those players that we, definitely targeted from the beginning.
So number one, Chris Johnson, number two, Jared Cook, number three, Tyrone Calico. I'm guessing Javon Kearse was either before your time or you weren't involved in that one.
You know, Javon, I was not at Javon's workout. I saw him at the combine, which was special, but I like to combine the combine and the on the field workout at the pro day, which I was not at his pro day workout. I was at the combine where he was in 99 and was part of that draft, and but I was not there at his private workout, which I did hear about and saw on video. But his workout, it's funny because Javon was just obviously nicknamed the freak, but everything about him was. He went down and ran a 4.40 on grass on the Florida football field. He ended up had a vertical jump of around 37 inches, which he was upset about. When we drafted him and brought him into the facility, one of the first things our strength and conditioning coach wanted to do was get some numbers on every single player and just kind of build off of that each year and see if you can maintain a 40, see if you can maintain a vertical, that type of thing. He's since quit that about 15 years ago. But at that time, he was doing that every year with players. And what happened is Javon walked in the building and he knew he could run. He knew he could jump. So the ceiling in our weight room was about 13 feet off the ground. So he said, our strength and conditioning coach, Steve Watterson at the time, said, I need you to do a vertical. He said, I'm not doing a vertical. And Steve said, no, you're doing a vertical. He said, I don't need to do a vertical. He said, if I jump up and knock out one of those tiles in the roof, do I have to do a vertical? Watterson looked up at the ceiling, saw that it was 12, 13 feet high, and said, yeah, if you knock that tile off, you don't have to do a vertical. Javon took two steps, jumped up, knocked the tile off, and walked out of the room at that point. So he didn't ever have to register a vertical, but his vertical was up there. Excellent length, hands, arms, just unbelievably gifted athlete. Could really do whatever he wanted to do from an athletic standpoint. And I've seen Javon recently, and he still looks like a 21-year-old that works out every day, but he doesn't. Never really had to work out to get the body and the frame and the speed that he had. He's just naturally gifted.
Yeah, one of the most fitting nicknames of a guy that passed through. Stage three of this, I wanted to talk quarterbacks just a little bit, and I'm wondering, I'm curious about how much you guys talk about comps during draft meetings when you present on a guy maybe from your region. Do you say, hey, this guy's a little bit like so-and-so, or he's got an arm that reminds me of so-and-so, but he doesn't run like him, or those kind of things. How much do you operate on comps like that? How much is that a good ground for comparison? Or how much do you maybe try to steer away from him in certain respects when maybe you feel like it for some reason might not serve a guy well or not serve a scouting report well?
You know, if you're trying to sell a player a certain way, if you really want to sell him in a positive manner to the GM, make sure your comp comparable that you're using is someone that the GM likes. Don't use a comp that he doesn't really like. And that's very important. You know, when you talk about comparing quarterbacks, always be afraid of the greats. Always be afraid of the Hall of Famers. Unless you think this player, which we do have grades that will actually say, you know, Pro Bowl or Hall of Fame worthy, that type of thing. Those grades are very rarely given out, only in special circumstances. But, you know, when you compare a quarterback, everyone is seen the other quarterbacks you're comparing them to. So whether it's a GM or a coach, and maybe a coach has coached this player at another time. So, you know, you always have to be a little bit leery about some of these comps, but they are very important, especially later in the draft when you're talking about a player that maybe just the scout has seen. Comparables are very important to kind of paint a picture of what the player looks like for the general manager, for the coach that's in the room that's listening to the report. But when you're talking about comparables to Vince Young, I thought that was one of the more difficult ones. I thought at that time you didn't have a lot of the athletic runaround type quarterbacks. You had some that failed in the Tony Bankses out of the Michigan States, and so you didn't want to compare him to someone like that if you're going to give him a grade that is a starting caliber type grade. So the comp that we had, and I did Vince coming out that year, and C.O. Bricado was the lead scout in that area, and C.O. had gotten sick and ended up on bed rest for a while, and so I had to kind of take over his area at that time. But the comp that kept coming up from both of us was Randall Cunningham, and it's because of the size and the athleticism, the run first ability, the inability to be accurate with all throws, wanting to run before passing, that type of thing. And it wasn't a selling point. Even though Randall played a long time in the NFL, he was a solid quarterback at times, but he wasn't a special one. And Randall was the one that kept coming up for both of us as a comparable. And there just weren't really a lot at that time. You weren't going to put a comp on him of a Steve Young or that type because, you know, Steve was super smart and very accurate, short to intermediate, ran a little bit different offense. But you couldn't put those type of comps on a player like that. So, you know, he was a rare guy in terms of coming up at the time as a quarterback. So, you know, Vince was a hard one to really pinpoint. You know, Jake Locker was a little bit different. We had Mike Munchak as our head coach. Mike kind of saw what he wanted to do as an offense at that time was to be more like the old Titans with Steve McNair. And there were a lot of characteristics that Jake had that Steve had. Great athlete, multi-sport athlete. Steve McNair was a great baseball player drafted in the major leagues. Jake Locker was a drafted player in the major leagues and really highly thought of baseball prospect. Both of them were physically built to take punishment. Both of them had a lot of injuries. McNair later in the pros more than he did at Alcorn State. Jake had him at Washington and in the NFL, obviously. You know, I don't know if many people know, for a long time, Steve McNair held the record in Mississippi for the most interceptions in the state of Mississippi. He actually tied with Terrell Buckley out of high school. I think it was like 32, 33 interceptions. Steve was a great athlete alongside Jake. But the other comparable, I thought, to Jake Locker was Donovan McNabb a little bit. The way he was built, the way he threw the ball, there was a little bit of comparison there as well. We wanted to have that offense that fit what Steve did and for Jake to move into kind of that role, that quiet leadership. Jake had it, and a lot of the physical characteristics of Steve McNair. So, you know, moving on to Marcus, that offense, you know, kind of gave you the comparables of fitting someone that played in an offense in college like Marcus did. You know, the zone read, the spread, the shotgun. You know, Alex Smith was the first one to come to mind when you started to look at someone like Marcus Mariota. But Marcus was such a better athlete in terms of just flat-out foot speed, long speed. You know, the way he was physically built was a little bit different than Alex. You know, I thought there were couple different comparables to for Marcus's game. I thought Alex Smith was one, but I thought the way he moved on the outside of the offense, I thought was much better than Alex, and he had a lot of that. And I'll go back to that name, Steve Young. Steve Young was an excellent thrower on the run, definitely to his left as a left-handed quarterback. Marcus was an excellent rolling out to his right quarterback, very accurate. So he had that dual comparison, kind of like Jake.
Finally, Blake, after you were on with us most recently on Midday 180, I took a little grief from a couple friends because I didn't hammer you. I was like, hey, I hammered him the first time he was on, but they were like, you did not do your usual aggressive take. So a lot of these guys we've talked about were great prospects coming out, and you're not the guy making the final call, obviously. Locker didn't pan out. VY didn't pan out to the degree many thought he could have. And we know that Bud was instrumental in that. Calico, like we talked about, got hurt. Cook didn't maybe make quite the splash that people wanted and didn't get a second contract here. When you look back to somebody that you lobbied for, and I don't know how hard you lobbied for any of those guys, but when you look back to somebody you lobbied for, who's somebody you regret or that you kick yourself, and I'm sure every scout has these guys that you kick yourself and say, I should have known, or I should have seen that coming, or I overlooked that, or something about him made me not want to see that and emphasize a positive as opposed to that negative. Who's a guy or two that you wish you could take back?
You know, I would say definitely one player that always comes to mind for me, and it was a fourth-round draft choice, but it was somewhat early in my career, was player Michael Waddell. Michael Waddell was a fourth-round corner out of North Carolina. Michael ran a 4.31 at his workout, and he was a player that led the NCAA in kickoff return yardage. He averaged just right around 30 yards per kickoff. One thing that happened when he came to our place, he was very light anyway. We knew he was light. I knew he was light. But, you know, he was a player that really struggled to match up with the physicality of the game. He was really a good kickoff returner. We wanted him to be a punt returner, and I kind of sold him as a punt returner, and he was not. He just did not have that ability. When I talked about Chris Johnson's speed, his great speed was on his second to third step. Michael was a little bit more of a build-up to top end. You can do that as a kickoff returner, but you can't do that as a punt returner. And he was definitely one, even though it was a fourth-round pick, was someone that I really sold. I was probably the only scout that did Michael that year that really liked him that high, and I pushed for it. And he was ended up just being a kickoff return guy and a backup corner. I remember I thought I was going to see a player about to take off, and he ended up getting hurt at home. I think he slipped chasing his kid around the kitchen or something, and tore his quad. And once he tore his quad, it was all over. He was done. And I would say probably he was probably one of another player that I sold pretty hard and thought he was going to match up really well was Gerald McGrath. McGrath was a fourth round pick out of Southern Miss, and I thought Gerald was just going to be he was a really good college linebacker. He was always a little light. He was always struggling to get over the, you know, the 220, 225 range, but he could really run in a straight line. Gerald was all in terms of being an aggressive, competitor type player. He just had stiffness that I thought, a little stiffness in the hips. He could run a straight line, but the lateral mobility was just average. You know, with the light frame and the average lateral mobility, he was stuck on blocks a lot, couldn't get off. You know, he ended up being a solid special teams player, but, you know, not a player that, you know, I think ever really was worth what I thought he was going to be. I gave him a little bit better grade than where we even took him in the fourth round. And fourth round is fine. When you take a player like that, that's probably what he is. He's usually a backup to a special teams type player that may ascend to be a starter. And that's what he ended up being. But I really felt that he could be a better player. And, you know, I think probably the one, if I go to the final one, is Justin Hunter. You know, Justin had all the physical ability in the world. He's got the leaping ability. He's got the speed. He's got the catching radius. He's got the long arms and good hands. Justin in practice on a weekly and daily basis would abuse our corners, especially in the red zone. But we never really saw him play much in the red zone. And he was a player that when he played was fine. And he ended up getting hurt a few years in a row, a couple of bad injuries just when you thought he was coming on. But he was a guy that I sold pretty hard and thought he would really develop, you know, with the team that we had at that time. But just really never developed to the point to where he was worth that. Really, it was a top of the second round pick that we moved up for, and just really never developed to the point to where I thought he would be. And I thought he would be a red zone threat and a stretch of field type receiver, and he just never ended up doing it. He's still in the league. He's playing for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And if he's ever going to develop, that's probably the best system for him. They seem to take – their receivers coach seems to take players that – and develop them as good as they can. So, you know, I think he's a guy that I would probably rank at the top of my list there.
Do scouts talk about the like when you're sitting around having a cocktail or beer at the combine, or when you run into somebody on the road? You guys talk about those misses?
No question about it. You know, we all have them. You know, we write probably 450 reports a year on players, and you know, you're going to sell certain players, and you know, you end up doing a lot of work on these guys, and it's a 12-month process when you're talking about most players. You really dig into their background and get to know them if you can, get to know them as people, and you find out so much about them, and you've watched them so many times live. And I'm talking about, if you're talking about a senior player, you've watched them probably live. And if you're talking about a top draft choice, you've seen them play and practice, I would say 10 times each. And then that's not even counting what you see at an all-star game or the combine and the pro days. You know, you're seeing practices and games, and it's just amazing the amount of times you get to see them in person, not only on, you know, not only in person, but on film as well. So, you know, there's so much that goes into these players that, you know, when you sell them to a general manager, you feel pretty good.
Yeah. It's great insight from somebody who's in the middle of it for 19 years with the team everybody here is interested in. Really appreciate Blake Bedingfield joining us. You'll hear more of him, I hope, soon on the Midday 180. And if not on a podcast here, splashed into some of the stuff I write at Paul. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much. And keep up the good work. We appreciate you sharing. This is insight that we don't really get. And so you're really unique in that. And we're lucky that you're willing to share a lot of this stuff with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it, Paul.
That's it for the Paul Kuharsky podcast this week, brought to you by Yazoo Beer. Pick up a 6-pack or get one next time you're out having a drink with your friends or family. Appreciate all your support at paulkuharsky.com. Tell your friends, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks.
The Paul Kuharsky Podcast is a joint production of paulkuharsky.com and Vocal. For more information and more programming, please visit vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com.